looking back, had I not gone through all those struggles before, I wouldn't be the person that I am today. I wouldn't be able to accomplish all that. And I wouldn't be able to, I have people that come to me. I almost serve as the messenger, or not a messenger. I don't know if messenger is the right word, but the bridge between the two worlds. Especially in my family tree, a lot of people, I connect the older generations and the younger generations together.
All right, welcome to another episode of Navigating the Rise. Today I have this awesome lady named Vivian Tran, Dr. Vivian Tran, and she's working on a new book, among other things. So I'll let her describe herself and what she's working on at this moment.
Thank you, George. Good morning, afternoon, evening, wherever you may be around the nation or around the globe. I am, to George's point, I am a recent doctorate graduate. I have my PhD in business psychology. In essence, what that means is I focus a lot on the study of human interactions in the workplace, specifically with an approach on cultural studies. My doctoral research is on understanding Chinese entrepreneurs and their challenges in being successful in the United States. So that was one study, area of study. I'm currently working on a fiction novel, which addresses the second generation Asian Americans in the United States. So I always call them like almost like the forgotten population. There's a lot of books and literature on immigration stories, successful or their challenges, whatever they may be, but there's not a lot of stories that focus in on our population, the population that grew up with almost one foot in each world, but never truly belonging to either one. So that's what I'm working on.
Wow. And this is the first time I heard about this business psychology thing about how the people interaction within that workplace. Is there anything that's different between the business psychology, that environment versus social setting? Is there any nuances that people don't even recognize?
Yes. So in business psychology, really looks at the health of an organization. So you can almost call me the personable business consultant. So unlike your average business consultant who will go in there and make, what's a good way to put it? With no offense to your normal business consultants, but I'm more personable. I look at employee relations, motivation, engagement, that type of scenario. How do I leverage the resources that you have currently have and maximize them so that the overall health of your organization improves?
So when you say health, is it tied to a specific metrics? Is it tied to revenue? Is it tied to happiness from like the Gallup survey of the company? How do people measure that?
So that's a very good question, and that's actually dependent on each organization's needs. So for example, one organization may be focused on employee morale, while another organization may be focused on strategic growth or executive coaching. Whatever that might be, that's where we come in and we assess what that need is, then work with our clients to develop programs, I guess that's the best way to put it, to tailored programs that we can work directly with. I mean, I talk like a business consultant. I'm actually not one, but that's the field that I study for.
Awesome. Cool. That's good, because right now there's actually been study. I used to be, when I was at work, it was be like where they want people to be engaged, because happy, engaged employees means better profits for the company. So
definitely. Yeah. One quick little takeaway or no fun fact, I guess you would call it. The newer generations, they care more about their contributions and whether or not they have an identity with an organization than a stable job, stable pay, that sort of stuff. So the shift in talent and their dynamics are changing. And so as an organization, they have to also shift in order to stay competitive.
So when you say newer generation, are you talking about generation like Z or Gen Y or the one after Z? Which one are you talking about?
I can't keep track of the generations anymore, but it's actually millennials and on.
Oh, really?
So I would say it starts with the tail end of Y and onward.
Ah, I see. So I think one thing could be that, so I have a theory, tell me if I'm wrong, that can happen is because like US and perhaps other developed countries, we're in a place where we live very comfortably, even though we would complain about certain things, but for the most part, we're pretty good overall in terms of lifestyle. We live way better than people like 100, 200 years ago, like way better, right? Even the middle class is just way better. So from that perspective, and there's also been a study has been done where once you get past a certain income level where it can meet your whatever needs that you need, that the monetary aspect becomes less important and the other non-monetary aspect become more important. So I think maybe the Gen Y and Gen Z, they have all their like needs in terms of material needs all met very well. And now perhaps that's why they're now looking more for like a meaning, et cetera. Because to be frank, if you're like homeless, et cetera, you will not give a care about what meaning you are. You just want to get fat and like make sure to survive the next day.
You have a really good point. You touched on a very good topic. There's actually a theory. It's called Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs. It's an actual theory that this is usually in psychology but you can translate it over to this particular topic and I don't want to turn this into an academic session. So you can definitely go and look up Maslow's theory and he has a whole pyramid that starting at the very base level is basic survival. So in his theory, he basically says that there is a pyramid in which you have to first meet each level in order to advance to the next. So to your point, later generations, they've met this basic survival, you know, that they've checked that off, they're advancing to the next level of needs and upward. So to your point, you're right. Very good.
Cool. Yeah, I almost majored in psychology, actually. I was really interested in that. It was fascinating, psychology and statistics. But then at the time, the Asianness in me, or perhaps by my family's influence, that hey, it's not practical. What are you going to do with a psychology degree? What are you going to be a statistic? I guess statistic can be somewhat useful, but there wasn't a direct application unless you'd be an actuary or something like that, mm-hmm. right? So I ended up becoming an engineer for the most part. But the thing is, now I don't even do engineering. So so it's very interesting. But that's a topic for a different day. Let's talk about more about the other stuff you're working on. You mentioned about showcasing this fiction novel on second generation. You said specifically Chinese Americans. So I'm curious about...
Necessarily Chinese Americans. That was my dissertation. So my dissertation, I had to get very, very specific. And so I chose a specific population for the fiction novel. I want to focus more on Asian Americans, specifically the second generation population.
Cool. So you also mentioned about earlier that it's a forgotten population. Can you tell me more about that?
I mean, that's what I call it. It's not actually coined that way. I feel that's how it is, because if I look at my own experiences growing up, I grew up very, very confused, because by day I would go to school and I would learn the American way, being independent, being vocal, being an individual, right? And then I would come home and be told something else, be told to be humble, to be a collective group, you know, to hold traditional customs. And it's, to me, it was a constant dilemma. But at the same time, I didn't have the type of support group that would tell me that I'm going through cultural shock. I'm going through conflicts of interest. There are these types of psychological dilemmas are normal, and there was not that that type of support to help me navigate. And it was a big struggle, identity crisis, cultural identity, all that fun stuff. It wasn't fun growing up.
Yeah, I think that happens a lot, especially immigrants. There are two major immigrants that I know of in the U.S. that suffer this kind of dichotomy or dual identity crisis. One is the Asian American I speak of. Other one is Latin Americans, actually. They go through the same thing too. And the reason they go through the same thing is because in culture, in Latin American culture, language is very important. So if you do not speak Spanish, you're not a real Latin American, right? So if we have this issue as well. So I think both, and if you look deeper into it, besides the fact that they're more affectionate than us Asian in general, Asian have more distance, but the core of that is actually very similar. So they also go through something similar as well. So it's very interesting. Of course, I was also a second generation, or I am, not I was, but I am. So I can definitely understand that. And I'm curious about, in terms of your book, what are some of the things I really want to highlight of this dual identity crisis, this loss, and among other things?
I feel that aside from addressing those issues, I want to emphasize that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. So there is a, like almost a, don't for, you know, yes, it you'll struggle now, but there's hope at the end of the light. So I started from a, I'm taking a step back. The novel is based off true events of my own personal experience. That's what I'm using to base the storyline. And so just reflecting now, like looking back, there were a lot of times where I not only was I frustrated, but I was also unconsciously or subconsciously building up resentment. And you know, there was a lot of struggles. But now looking back, I'm very glad that I actually went through it, because now I've become this person, this really, I mean, I'm not superwoman, but I feel like I can now navigate between both worlds very smoothly, easily. I can just kind of sway back and forth to my liking. I'm fluent in both Cantonese and Mandarin. I don't have to, you can hear my English, it's perfectly fine. But so it's looking back, had I not gone through all those struggles before, I wouldn't be the person that I am today. I wouldn't be able to accomplish all that. And I wouldn't be able to, I have people that come to me, I almost serve as the messenger, or not a messenger, I don't know if messenger is the right word, but the bridge between the two worlds. I, especially in my family tree, a lot of people, I connect the older generations and the younger generations together.
Wow, that's pretty awesome. So, because from that perspective, it just makes a lot of sense. So you can actually apply that to business. So actually one of my engagement I was working on, where in a business setting, the management team who are of in Australia are having a hard time communicating with the team in China. So I was able to actually help with that business communication. And similarly, when I was working at a Japanese company, there was a US counterpart and Japanese counterpart, where I was able to start also help with some of the communication issues. So that is definitely an asset that people can't really quantify until they see it in action.
Definitely. And there's also studies where they say that when you're multicultural in the work setting, it actually flexes your muscle to kind of think outside the walls.
So that's interesting. Let's dig deeper about that. So this is very fascinating to me. And so when it comes to, it is, when it comes to that, it's from the multicultural perspective, there's been studies that show that people who have multicultural mind, they can do context switching. So what that means is that they can become a different person by doing context switch. So when you're with your Asian family or Asian culture, in this example, you act like a different person. And you go to your Western environment, you just immediately can just content switch right away. Like, so, so it's almost like people who know only see one side of you, only see half of you, because the other side that you showcase are completely different. And they're able to pivot that very quickly. Is that the same with that with you?
Definitely. And I actually have people, I remember people commenting. So I remember a friend that used to comment, she was very Americanized. She did not speak a word of Mandarin. I think her background was Taiwanese. And one day she came to me and she said, "I don't know why you keep telling me that you're super Asian, Vivian. I mean, you're Americanized. You're fully Americanized to me." I'm like, "To you, I am. Watch me in a different setting." And I actually had another friend where she did see me in different settings. So she is a first generation immigrant from Hong Kong. She came over to the U.S. When it's just me and her, I appear very Americanized to her. But one time I took her to a group of English-only speaking Asians. So it was English-only around the table, and it was just a small gathering. And there, afterwards, when we left, she said, "Okay, now I can see when I'm up against that group, I appear very, very Asian. When I'm with her, I'm very, very American." So, like, she can see the contrast.
I mean, so for me, I still have a hard time doing that context switch immediately. I thought I can do a pretty good job until I go back to the workplace. So what happened if I was in one city for too long, the transition period is a bit longer. So for example, when I was at, so of course I'm from the US, right? So I went to work in Asia for a little while. In the beginning, people thought I was just too blunt and I need to like tone it down. I need to like be, so in the US, I don't speak that loud, but for whatever reason, I remember that one time I was in Korea, my friends from Australia, from Singapore, from everywhere, "Jake, George, you're so loud. You know that?" I'm like, "What? What do you mean?" Like, I was been told that I have a soft spoken voice. They're like, "No, like think about our voice and your voice." So even though mine was considered soft by American standard, it was considered loud, right? And then, so of course, when I was in Asia for a very long time working in China, and I came back here, what happened is I was becoming more indirect, right? So it took me a while. So basically, in Asia, you don't ever challenge authorities. You listen, and then you kind of work around the issue as opposed to confronting it directly. So when I went back to the U.S. and started working again, I was there for like almost 3 months working abroad before I came back. And then so I was just listening and just trying to understand what's going on before I make my assertions, like a typical American would do. The loudest person gets hurt, right? And then so I just listening, and people are like, "George, you know, you need to be more assertive." It's like, you have no idea. I was like, no, I have idea. I'm just listening. I'm waiting until I get all the information, and then I'll deliver or my thoughts. And then it's like, oh, wait a minute. That wasn't it when I was in Asia, when I first got there. So it just takes, the longer I've been in one place for too long, the longer it takes me for do content stretching. Now, if I was always traveling back and forth, then it's not that bad. But when I there's that transition period, I would say.
No, it's definitely, as I remember going through that as well. I studied abroad in Hong Kong for a semester. And so I noticed myself kind of, at first there was a hard wall, a hard cultural shock wall. And I was surprised myself, given how bicultural I was. I thought I was. Apparently I was not as bicultural as I thought when I first got to Hong Kong. And I remember hitting that wall, and that wall eventually lessened thinner and thinner until towards the end. It's interesting. It's also the social dynamics. I've learned to kind of analyze the situation, the environment, and then pick the hat that I should put on. Mm.
Yeah, so there's another thing that's been going on too in the U.S. where I hear from anecdotal quotes from people where they say that as Asian American, they feel that the typical American does not accept them as American, and the Asians from Asia don't accept them as Asian. So I'm curious about your perspective on that.
It's very interesting. I'm not sure where to start. I mean, as you're talking, I have flashbacks of my childhood growing up and those experiences. It's so true. It's sad too, because I can't go around explaining to everyone. So for example, I can't go around explaining to somebody that's not Asian that I am Asian American. I mean, I speak perfect English. I'll stutter here and there, but I was born and raised on American soil. Heck, I'm qualified to be president if I wanted to. But a non-Asian American will walk up to me and say, "So where are you from?" No, I mean, where are you really from?
Yeah.
And that was, so experiencing that is a little bit hard. It's a little bit difficult because I don't need to defend myself. Why do I need to defend myself? I'm American. Yeah. That's it. You can hear the accent, the American accent in my voice. I am American. And then turn around, I used to have part-time jobs, and actually I had it like an average of 3 part-time jobs while I was in high school and college just to be on my own. And they were mainly in Chinese restaurants doing takeouts. And I would be packing because I could answer the phones, you know, in English, do all that part. But then all of my other workers were immigrants. So they spoke their native language, and I would get comments like, "Oh, you probably don't understand what that means. That's too deep for you." Or what was that? There's no direct translation. They would call me, they would give me a little nickname. It's called, in Cantonese, it's called "nongjuxing," which means you're kind of like, a silly word. It's a silly, semi-derogative nickname calling you, silly American or something along those lines. But they would poke fun at me like that. So I'm like, okay, well, that's what I mean. You have one foot in each door, but you don't really belong in either world.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So I'm curious now, like with your book that you're writing or trying to dispersed throughout the world, what are some of the things that you hope that whoever's reading your book would take away from?
The first thing I want them to know is that they are not alone. That's the first thing I want them to know, is you're not alone. It is not you against the world. As though sometimes it may feel that way, but there are others like that, like you, just like you around the world, going through the same thing. And we just need to know how to address them, how to first acknowledge them, then address them appropriately. And if we don't, then you have all these psychological issues that come out, like resentment, like burst, outbursts and things like that. Passive aggressiveness, things that we don't want happening.
Yeah, it's like childhood traumas and then carry on to adulthood. Got it.
Yes, that too. Yes, that too.
So in the process of even trying to come up with that story, come up with the book, so what are some of the challenges and what are some of the things that were less challenged that you thought it would have been in that journey so far?
So I'm very lucky. I actually found a partner. So doing with this and or with any other project. So for example, I also have a startup that I'm working on, is really to know where your strengths are and to acknowledge where your areas are of improvements are, right? So my strength is on the business side. So I'm really the storyteller. I give all the content, I provide my experiences, and then I also work on the business side, the marketing side. But creative writing, I cringe. I cringe, but I recognize that. So I recognize it, and so I have a partner that will complement me in that aspect, that she's taking all the content that I'm giving her and she's actually making a full story out of it.
Wow. Sounds good. That's pretty awesome.
So, yeah, it's about finding the right partner. So I'm working with someone else on a software startup, and I'm not a programmer, I know that. But again, I'm the business side. I can do the operations, I can plan out the strategic operations, the growth, and do all that. And so together we are a team, you know.
Oh, that's good. So I'm working on a couple of things too as well. The thing is, for me, I have very high standards, and then so a lot of times that like I will be working with someone initially just to see how it goes, and I realize, man, I can do a better job than that. Forget it. I'm not partnering with you. So like one example was, I'm also currently writing a book too. But then I had someone I wanted to contract out because I just don't have time to write a book full out. And so what happened was, I had someone just to, as a contractor, I suppose, like together, a partner. Basically, I just want to say, you know, just write one chapter for me. I want to just see how you write, and I'll pay you for that chapter. So I did pay him for that chapter. And then, but the thing is, when it came back, it was like, oh my God, I can write better than that. So I was like, oh, and writing is not my strongest suit. It's like, oh man, this is not good. So from that perspective, right, so far, I think I might need to have your skills into pairing up with the right people. My other skill that I know that I'm not very good at is, I think it's because of the Asian culture that's in me. We've got to be humble and that kind of things, where my friend has always told me that I constantly undersell myself because I don't market myself as well as I should have. And so every time when they would redo my resume and stuff, the moment they redo my resume, like, I get interview calls immediately. And they just love me in interviews too. Whenever I don't do it, I left my resume on for a while, I don't update it, and I have a harder time because the fact that I thought there's that communication where it says, in Asian culture, you don't flaunt it. People should just know, you should act around it. Whereas in the American culture, it's like, you gotta say it as much as you can because everyone else is doing it. If you don't do it, people think you're not as good, right? So it's a completely different dynamic.
Right. Right. I always use that example. That's a perfect example, right? Because, you know, individualism and collectivism is, if you look on the charts, they're actually on polar opposite ends. In the US, we are an individual country. People thrive on being unique, standing out. And I'm just using Chinese because that's my ethnic background. So in the Chinese culture, you have to be a collective group. You know, that's the norm. Yeah, I went through that growing up as well. And I noticed that's one of the things where I had to take off the Asian hat, put the American hat on. All right. Okay. Now we're thriving.
Yeah. And then the thing is, so now going back to another study that I was studying with a human behaviors professor. He was also talking about how that you can become a different person. We now talk about we can shift to a different person before, about different contexts, different people, but actually you start to think differently too. They said, depending on the language you're using, you start thinking differently because of the way how language can impact your thought process, especially language that basically have attached feminism or masculinity to certain words. So when you start thinking in that language, you actually your brain process also changed significantly.
Okay.
I wasn't sure how that experience.
Okay. I don't actually recall a specific experience though.
Okay. Got it. Like, so I think maybe that applies more towards the Western countries, or like, for example, French. Okay. They have a gender for each, I think there are two.
Yes.
There are two languages that are polar opposite. I forgot which one, but like one doesn't say the moon is a female, and the other language say moon is a male. And depending on that, it's like it can change your thinking process in moving forward.
Interesting. Okay. I can see how that would correlate. I've never thought of it that way, but it's very interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Maybe another tool you can add to your business psychology arsenal.
Okay.
Cool. Well, so we're getting to the end of our show. So just want to summarize everything we talked about. Let me know, Vivian, if I missed anything. So first of all, Vivian has a background in business psychology. She focused on a lot of different things in the workplace from her studies, and such employee morale, and how to create a program, tailored program for you, for companies to actually make that make a healthy, workable place. And right now she's focused on writing a book where we talked about different things about Asian Americans and how to make sure that they're not alone in that instance, and that they're, especially with the newer generations of, where among Asian Americans too, where they're focusing more on the contribution they can have in society as opposed to, say, the pure traditional paycheck. And so from that perspective, and also she closed it off that sometimes to start endeavor, you got to find the right partner to actually make sure that complements your weakness as well as your strength, so you can make a great team. So am I missing anything from my summary, Vivian?
No, I think that's a great summary. I just remember there's light at the end of the tunnel. You'll make it there.
Well, awesome. So if for people who wants to contact you, what's the best way?
You can definitely find me on LinkedIn. My name is Vivian Tran. I believe it's linkedin.com/VivianTranVT. So my initials at the very end.
Cool.
Yeah. But awesome. I would definitely love support on my book project. I do have a Facebook page up that I'm building, and I occasionally release updates about the book and its progress. So definitely look us up on facebook.com/Asian Duckling. So that's the title of the book. It's called The Asian Duckling. So kind of like a spin-off of The Ugly Duckling.
Cool. And it becomes the swan. Got it. Cool. I like that.
Right. Exactly.
Well, so thank you so much, Vivian, for coming on to the show.
Thank you for having me, George.